I'm Alec Baldwin, and my new podcast from WNYC is about following great conversations to unexpected places. I'll talk to actors.
You know, if I get one more drunken guy,
hey, man, greed is good.
Makers of public policy.
Politics is barbaric.
Critics and comedians.
I always work out the material in West Palm Beach.
No, get out of here.
I want to know what motivates them.
Turn down a lot of things. So basic body heat, 2, 3, 4, 5.
How do they feel about what they do?
I don't mince words.
Do you wish you had? My show is called Here's the Thing. It's my chance to talk with people I want to know more about.
This podcast of Here's the Thing is supported by Stitcher, offering the Stitcher mobile app. Listeners can access episodes of Alec Baldwin's Here's the Thing, as well as thousands of other podcasts without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/WNYC. Support also comes from the Book of Mormon, from the creators of South Park, the new musical that Entertainment Weekly says is what 21st century Broadway can be, now playing at the Eugene O'Neill Theater on Broadway. Tickets available at telecharge.com.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and here's the thing.
We're here for Mr. Douglas.
Michael Douglas is American acting royalty.
Thank you, sir. Well,
he's the son of Kirk Douglas, one of the greatest actors this country has ever seen, in my opinion. That alone would ensure him a place at anyone's dinner party. But Michael Douglas is his own man. He has 2 Academy Awards as an actor and a producer, and has played some of the most iconic roles in film over the past 30 years. Roles that have challenged the way we think about family, power, money, sex. Gordon Gekko in Wall Street, Nick Curran in Basic Instinct, as well as Romancing the Stone, Traffic, and Wonder Boys.
Hello.
Michael was at his home in New York City when I visited with him. He's worked with everyone from Oliver Stone to Curtis Hanson to Steven Soderbergh. In 1987, he worked with British director Adrian Lyne on Fatal Attraction. Douglas says Lyne was one of the best.
He was great, and he has a great knack and talent for that. And I remember, you know, when Glenn and I, when we were doing Fatal Attraction, and we had the scene in the kitchen, the first time when we were kind of going at it, got her up on the kitchen sink, and so he did a take on that, and said, "Well, that was wonderful, love. That was just great. What could we do?" I think, and Glenn said, "Well, maybe I can take the water and I can stick my wet fingers in his mouth. Lovely, lovely, yes, lovely, lovely."
How many of your fingers can you grab into his mouth? Can you get all of your fingers into his mouth, darling?
Exactly.
I'd love to see that.
He was great. He was great.
I love his films
and a lot of fun. Every day, he said, "Well, do you want me?" I said, "I should get and shape this picture." No, you're a New York lawyer. You should look good just the way you are. Yes. And in about 3 weeks, "Geez, Mike, you look like Orson Welles." But that's that favor. They love to shoot that down angle, you know, and we all look better with the camera above our eye line.
And the older I get, raise that camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you drop that camera, you.
Yeah.
When you work now, what's it been like for you now in terms of you show up and you're pretty facile at getting there emotionally in terms of how you want to play it? And is it more technical for you?
Yeah. Someone early on in my career told me, you know, the camera can always tell when you're lying. Ooh, I was like, the camera can tell when I'm lying. So I used
to
method it.
Thank God I wasn't on that date with me last night. Good God.
Well, I used to method it up. I got to be truthful. One day I said, wait a minute. I lie every day. I said, but Ian, I lie.
The camera can tell if you're lying, not me.
Not me. Exactly.
I'm different. I'm talented.
Right, exactly. What's acting about except lying?
Yeah.
That freed me up a whole lot when I realized that. But the last 10 years, the biz has changed dramatically. The technical part is definitely...
To me now, it's all, you know, where's my light? Where's the camera? Raise that camera. I used to say, well, we got to have a clean take. And I got to burn one great connected master. Now I'm like, we're going to do 4 pickups of this line. And it's so technical to me now. It's unbelievable.
I learned that a lot from actually from Jack Nicholson on Cuckoo's Nest. I was watching, you know, it's editing. You do sometimes take after take, and then you go sometimes look at the dailies and you see how minute the differences are. And then they can judiciously edit.
I mean, I was working with some people early on because I didn't know better. And I was looking at people and I'd say, my God, when they watch the dailies of this, they're going to really be unhappy because this person's as boring as you could possibly imagine. They're not doing anything. And that was my sin, was I felt like I always had to be acting or doing something. And I guess my question is, sometimes you go to work and you know what you want to do. What do you do when you go to a movie and the director has nothing to offer you? He's really just a traffic cop pointing a camera.
My feeling is with movies, I mean, first of all, you get a good part. And The Gecko is a great part, you know? And sometimes you get a good part. And a lot of pictures I've done where I'm in every single scene and I'm carrying the plot line, and somebody else has got the colorful good part. But I always think that if the picture's cast properly or if you're cast right, I never expect to hear much from a director.
You don't?
No.
The world is so different now. I've got people walking up to me all the time quoting some of the most corrosive lines from Glengarry, Glenn Ross. They think it's good to talk about the kind of thuggishness of the sales industry when I say, you know, coffee is for closers and you say greed is good. Do you think in our lifetime that line has changed, greed is good, where people really believe that's true?
Well, the affirmation that I got from that villain,
From that community,
you know, if I get one more drunken guy from the street, go, hey, man, greed is good. You're the man. You're why I got into this business and everything. I go, hey, you know,
I was
a villain.
I got people walking to me drunk in the lobbies of hotels, and they're going, come do that speech for us. I'm in sales, baby.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, you don't get it, man. This is like, well, Arthur Miller, we're trying to wake you up. But they're like, no, they don't get it.
No, they love the accoutrements, and you spoke well.
What is your relationship to going to the movies now?
Yeah, I'm really embarrassed to say this, but I'm not a moviegoer. I don't see many movies.
Why?
I waste so much time watching news and sports. I love watching sports. But, you know, I can't tell you how it's going to end. My problem with movies, you know, is you get halfway through a movie. You see, I was right. I love making movies, but I'm really bad, Alex, when it comes to seeing them.
When you were younger, did you always sense you were headed in this direction in some way?
No, I never thought I was good. I mean, probably a lot of it was resentment as a young kid, my folks getting divorced and both of them being actors, but I never even thought about doing this at all. And I said I was like a junior in college.
What were you dreaming of doing back then?
Nothing, really. I was a hippie, you know, and I mean, in the early 60s, and they took me into the vice chancellor's office. I mean, you're in your third year of college, and you're not a major, you know. All right, so I guess, you know, drama should be easy. You know, I got both parents. I hung around. My mother was in, did a lot of theater, and so I hung around there. But it was not something I dreamed about.
But the success you have now came in stages. When you were younger and you did your early films, you were what you said, the gentle young man.
Right.
But I wonder in your case, because you eventually played a very tough, very powerful actor on film. So do you think when you were younger, you pulled your punches because you didn't want to step on what you thought was your dad's territory? You didn't want to be compared to him?
First of all, you look at his career. He played the sensitive young man for his first 6 or 7 pictures until he did a movie called The Champion. I just think I was just trying to define who I am, because the one problem about being second generation is, you know, half of me is made up of my father's genes. My mother, Diana's an actress too, but not as well known. So when you see behavioral or mannerisms that are like your father, I feel like it takes away from your individuality, right? And it's sort of like, oh, earlier on, I just was trying to find out who I was, and being a nice guy was a way of pleasing everybody. But the truth be told, a villain's the best way to go.
Yeah.
Playing a bad guy
is better lines,
it's more colorful. Audiences vicariously love you, because a lot of times everything that they want to do in real life, but they can't do what you can do in the movies. Contrarily, women, it's taken them so much longer to be comfortable in playing the villains. I mean, I look back to when I was producing Cuckoo's Nest and all the actresses that turned down the part of Nurse Ratched because they didn't want to play a villain. Louise Fletcher gets an Oscar for playing it well.
When I went to Strasbourg, the acting school, We did a gender-reversed production of Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, really?
And the girl was McMurphy. Oh. And all the inmates were females, and I was Nurse Ratched as a man.
Ah, that's a great idea.
Is your relationship with your dad more father-son now, or is it more two great colleagues in motion picture history?
No, it's more father-son.
It is.
It's more father. I mean, he's 94 years old. I'm just so proud of him. And, you know, he wasn't a great dad as in the prime as an actor. He was, like a lot of us were, consumed with his career. For him, it really started when he had his helicopter accident when he was 70 with a friend's helicopter, and they hit a aerobatic plane when they were taking off, and the people in the aerobatic plane crashed and died instantly, and the helicopter dropped about 40 feet, and he just was black and blue. Started him on this, you know, why am I alive, and this 18-year-old student pilot and the instructor dead. So he started getting back into his religion, reading the Talmud, reading the Old Testament, working with a rabbi, and has become a much more spiritual person. And I look to him with all of the great things that he's achieved in his acting career and producing career, which a lot of people don't really realize how much he produced. I am in so awe of him in the third act of his life. And I'm 66 now, and I think of him being 70 and what he's accomplished between 70 and 94, which is about 9 books. Called him last week. The housekeeper said he's down at the office. What the hell are you doing down at the office? You know, he says, well, I'm just finishing the edit on my last book. You got another book, Dad? He says, yeah. What else? He says, well, I got a book on sculptures. He says, wow, that's good, Dad. That's really good. You know, so he's on. So I look at him much more as a father now, because I'm, you know, much less competitive with him.
What did he do to you or not do for you, the positive or the negative, that you've passed on to your children?
The negative is you got to watch your quick temper.
You think you had a temper like your dad?
No, I didn't have one quite.
Few people did.
I mean, there was a reason why you saw
that. Big Mitch Kelly.
Yeah, you said right. I think I realize now, because he's a white Russian Jew, you know, Belarus and all of that. And
he was pissed off at his dad.
That and also he saw how much anti-Semitism there was in the world, because people would talk to him as they didn't know he was a Jew. How much?
Mr. Douglas, please come sit down. Yeah, nice to be in the club. Well, there are none of those people around, is it?
Exactly.
He would see that.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. Because he changed his name. It was no longer Danielovich.
Didn't have as bad a temper as him.
Not as bad. I mean, I've learned to monitor it. Be aware of it. You used to have a short handle.
I used to. I'm a lot better now.
Yeah.
Because I don't care as much. That was the trick.
There's things that you can't control. Is that God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference,
right,
and it's
on.
True.
Mine was even worse. It was even more narcissistic. I was just angry because nobody else cared about it, whatever it was, as much as I did. I wonder, what was your relationship like with your mom in terms of your career? What would you and she talk about? Did she have a lot to say to you about the business and what she thought about what you did? You seemed very geared toward making your dad proud.
Well, my mother's of English background. She was not so much the business. She's very bright and was probably more politely critical of me as an actor. It was not bad.
What did you get from your mother?
What
of your mother is in you?
Diplomacy.
The guy that could produce films?
I think Jack Lemmon said it when we were doing China Syndrome. He said, Michael, he said, he hits you with 1,000 powder puffs, you know.
It takes that to produce.
Yeah.
To be able to massage people and work with them and get
top
people to work
together.
Yeah, rather
than confrontational. You know, it really does to try to get people in that way. And I think she has that. I think my father has made it more difficult for himself in his confrontational and his anger, you know, in his career. The positive side of Kirk is a sense of tenacity and stamina. My son is a cross-country runner now.
Your son's?
My 10-year-old son, Dylan.
Yeah. Dylan.
Dylan, right.
You doing this now at 10 years old?
Yeah,
serious.
He's already starting.
Track aficionado?
About his track stuff.
And your older son has had his problems. What's been your relationship with your son's alcoholism and drug addiction?
I think there's a certain genetic part. And I think as far as drug addiction, you know, your peer group plays a huge part of that. I'm of the belief that, you know, at 13, 14 years old, as a parent, you've lost a lot of your influence.
They're taking their signals from other people.
From other people and by their peer group. That triggers and starts it off. And then in my older son's case, there was no end until he was incarcerated. I think secrets play a part in this, in the fact that whether it's a bad marital relationship that you're trying to keep from your children and the tension is there and you're not really kind of up front. I mean, this go around, I'm finding myself much more honest with my 7-year-old daughter than I ever thought I would be. Also, just because of what they have access to. I mean, just watching Glee, which is our family night. You know, I don't know why I'm so surprised, but I am. I'm looking at it, and they're watching, you know, right along without any kind of ratings on it. You know, two boys kissing each other and all that, besides the gay actually physically seeing things in a free-for-all. And it's a little different. So I think that in that way, trying to get rid of his, or not keeping as many secrets.
Isn't it funny how people, men in particular, who have, and I don't want to put this delicately, who have played near the third rail, sexually speaking,
right,
are very sensitive about that when their right. children are growing up. They're like, no, don't need to watch that. Yeah. I mean, your dad has that great line. My son was sent to rehab for sex addiction. He thought, wow, I didn't realize that was a problem.
Right, yeah. I know.
How much did you inherit that? Which is, this is what men are supposed to do.
Probably
before your current marriage.
Probably, I'm sure, you know, I mean, I'm watching, I mean, my father's been very fortunate. His second wife, Anne, who's French, and they've been married 56 years, I think, and had a different attitude earlier on. He was a rascal.
More from my conversation with Michael Douglas is coming up in a minute. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Here's the Thing is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of Here's the Thing, Radio Lab, This American Life, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/Here's the Thing. I'm talking with Michael Douglas at his home in New York City. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. So you've been sick. What was your relationship to cancer before you had cancer? How was it in your life, family, friends?
Never really, nothing. My father, remember, had a little skin thing. My mother had, again, a slight skin issue, but no real history.
Wasn't an event in your life when you were young?
No.
And then what did you find out? How did yours play out?
Well, I actually was right after I finished the Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. My throat was a little sore, and I thought maybe it was from, you know, like from tension, from the part where you haven't placed your voice, where you're swallowing your words and you're speaking from the back of your throat. I had a little bit of a sore gum, and so I saw doctors, thought it was some sort of sore, and I had antibiotics, this and that. And then, you know, I lived with it and went on for another couple of months. Your general practitioner then sends you to experts. I go to an ear, nose, and throat guy and a periodontist and this and that. And another round of antibiotics. And then I went away for the summer, and I came back, and I was in Canada. And I called and said, listen, something's going on here, all right? Something is really going on here.
How much time has passed since you first felt?
Now we're in August, and I first went to him in January.
So it's almost more than half a year.
Yeah, half a year. Finding an ear, nose, and throat doctor at a Jewish hospital in Montreal, Quebec, and he literally opened my mouth, and he took a tongue depressor, and I'll never forget that moment when he looked up at me and looked back down. I knew. And he said, well, I guess we're going to have to take a biopsy. I said, a biopsy of... He said, well, there's a polyp here.
Roof of your mouth, gum line?
It was on my tongue. 2 days later, he called me back in and said, you got cancer for head and neck cancer. The best place was Sloan Kettering. And I went down and within a week and found out that it was stage 4, which is the maximum. So 7 weeks of radiation and chemo. The reality is, with all the doctors that I could have here in New York, if I had been checked back in January for head and neck cancer, this could have all happened a lot early. And the thing with cancer is you want to get it as early as you can.
Because I want to mention that I came to this door, to your home here in New York, fully expecting you to look, I'm going to be very honest with you, not as great as you look now. You look pretty damn good.
I went to Costa
Rica for a week,
Alec. You're
making me sick to my stomach right now.
I got to go to Costa Rica. You're working.
You look your normal self. You look fantastic.
Well, thank you. I lost a little bit of weight to help out, but you got a job.
I got a job, man. I got a job.
The one advantage of this is I'm deciding I'm taking the rest of this year easy. Enjoy my family and just take her easy.
Now, you had kids. You had your son's 10.
Right.
So you had your son when you were how old?
56.
God, I love that. Should I have more kids?
Yes. yes, I mean...
At this very moment, the door opens.
I think here's my daughter.
Wait a minute. This
is Karis.
Hello.
Karis, keep going. Hello, Alan.
Karis was coming home from school, and she jumped into the chair next to her dad's. Has she seen a couple of your films at least?
I have hardly any movies that she can see. Jewel and I...
And the other one, the stone thing.
Romancing the stone.
Those are like my favorite movies of all time.
Oh, really?
I love you, isn't it?
When I first saw it, I was just like...
Well, because a long time, she didn't really know what I did. You know, she knew Mommy because of Chicago and all that.
Sure.
Mommy was an actress. The longest time, you didn't know.
I once said to my friend, said, what does your dad do for a living? And I said, he makes pancakes. And they were like... I want to go to your house. I love pancakes.
Michael Douglas will be flipping pancakes for a few more months before he begins filming. The lead role in Liberace, Matt Damon, will be his lover.
Liberace was a lovely guy. I mean, the truth, I haven't played a lot of nice guys. When my dad was in his prime, Kirk, as an actor, there were good guys and bad guys, black hats and white hats. And not over analyzing it, but I think the Vietnam War had a lot to do with kind of redefining about, well, you know, we thought we were good, and then it was seen in a different light in some of the situations that we're in now.
This podcast comes from WNYC. Next up, political consultant extraordinaire, Ed Rollins. Who is someone that you've always wanted to talk to? Let me know at heresthething.org.